Support for Living on Earth comes from listeners like you. To make a donation, please use the link to the left of this webpage. And thanks.
October 20th marks half a year since the BP oil disaster. The explosion killed 11 workers, and before the well was capped, some 200 million gallons of oil had gushed into the Gulf of Mexico. Within days, the Obama administration imposed a moratorium on deepwater drilling in the Gulf. This past week, the feds lifted the ban and imposed much stricter safety rules and regulations on the oil industry. But much more murky is the state of the Gulf ecosystem. During the disaster, we spoke with many wildlife scientists. Now, 6 months later, Living on Earth's Jeff Young caught up with some of them to find out how the Gulf's doing.
It was mid-May when I last spoke with Melanie Driscoll of the Audubon Society's Louisiana Coastal Initiative. Driscoll walked the beach of Louisiana's Grand Isle, counting birds and looking for signs of the massive oil slick. She knew then that the ultimate effects would be hard to spot.
There's a saying about ecology that it's not rocket science. It's a lot more complicated than that. We're looking at a system. The birds rely not just on their feathers insulating them. They rely on food chains that are underwater or in the sand. They rely on protection from predators by being familiar with their surroundings. It's very complicated.
Federal records show that some 95 species of birds were collected from the Gulf Coast during the oil blowout. Nearly 7,000 died. And oddly, that's the good news. Driscoll says she had feared a much higher body count by now.
And what we know now is that the direct effects were much less than they might have been. Fewer birds were oiled and therefore less death initially. We're still very concerned, though, about the longer-term effects of oil in the food chain, oil in the environment, and that we may not be seeing the effects of on their reproduction or survival for a number of years.
Now, Driscoll is watching the fall migrants. They need the Delta's bounty of insects, worms, and crustaceans to fuel up for the flight south. Driscoll fears the oiled islands and wetlands might still be tainted or simply not offer enough food. So wildlife officials are trying to lure birds away from shore by flooding inland fields, creating new habitat. But Driscoll says many species are still drawn to the coasts where they always go. She's finding the most birds in the spots with the most remnant oil.
That's what we saw during this sort of six-month mark, was that because these areas are traditionally such good areas for birds, the birds are choosing to be there even though those are the areas that had the most oil. And so we have concerns that they may be having to work harder to fatten up, or they might not fatten up as well and therefore not be in as fit to fly across the Gulf.
Other scientists I spoke with share Driscoll's mix of relief about the oil's direct impact and uncertainty about the long term. Back in early July, groups that work with endangered sea turtles were looking at a dire situation. Turtles were coming ashore to nest just as the oil hit. Sea Turtle Conservancy Director David Godfrey told us about a daring plan to move the turtle nests.
Well, in essence, what we're trying to do is save this year's entire hatchling class of sea turtles from the North Gulf coast of Florida, from emerging from their nests and then swimming out into the Gulf to really meet almost certain doom.
Federal and state officials, nonprofit groups, and volunteers hand-dug some 25,000 eggs and loaded them into special containers. FedEx trucks carried them across the Florida Peninsula to oil-free waters of the Atlantic. It was unprecedented and risky. We called Godfrey back to see if it worked.
It did work, and it was the right thing to do. At the time, the oil conditions were such that we needed to do something to save those hatchlings. A very well-orchestrated plan was put in place, and we got it right.
About 15,000 hatchlings got a fresh start in the Atlantic. As for the turtles in the Gulf, some 600 dead have been collected. Whether the turtles can bounce back depends largely on how their habitat recovers from the oil. In late July, I took a boat trip near the mouth of the Mississippi with National Wildlife Federation conservation scientist Doug Inkley. Inkley was looking for the floating brown algae called sargassum. It's crucial habitat for sea turtle hatchlings, fish larvae, and other small creatures.
You can see how it's got a lot of surface area for eggs and larvae to hang on to.
Glob of oil on your hand there.
Oh yeah, there is oil coming right out of the sargassum.
Every place that we've seen sargassum so far, we're seeing the oil in blobs. So everything that's attracted to sargassum here is, in essence, being attracted to oil.
Then, rusty brown blobs lurked under the surface as far down as we could see. But just a little more than a month later, the Sea Turtle Conservancy's Godfrey found much better conditions.
You know, it was kind of surprising, to be honest with you, how normal it looked. Healthy mats of sargassum weed had floated in from other areas of the Gulf where they had never been exposed to oil. That sargassum was full of all the sorts of critters, fish, crabs, and even found a lot of healthy juvenile turtles in that habitat.
The surface looks good, Godfrey says, but most of the remaining oil is in the depths, where effects are harder to measure. Scientists I spoke with say it's far too early to know what's happening to deep-sea creatures or animals like the sperm whale and the bluefin tuna. The government has just started its full accounting of the spill's impact with what's called the Natural Resources Damage Assessment. NERDA, as it's known, can take years, and most researchers compiling that official report can't talk about their work. All of which means most answers about the Deepwater Horizon disaster are still on the distant horizon. For Living on Earth, I'm Jeff Young.
Just ahead, even a weatherman can't tell which way the wind is blowing for the nation's first offshore wind farm. Keep listening to Living on Earth.